NAFTA podcast.
Sometimes may be good, sometimes may be shit.
NAFTA podcast. It is our second preseason team breakdown. We're talking to Jack Pierce of the FYP podcast. He's going to tell us all about Crystal Palace. Excited to have him on. Jack, welcome to the NAFTA podcast. Welcome to the States.
Pleasure, John. Thanks for having me on. Love talking to anyone, anywhere about Palace. So, hopefully I can educate anyone that needs educating or just reinforce the good and the bad about Palace to anyone that knows a bit about Palace.
So. No, I know that we're really excited to have you here. We talked before we started recording about Palace being a lot of people's second favorite teams. Everyone who listens to our pod will know that I joke all the time they're my second favorite team. And I think what's really important for me is before we get you out of here, I have it as like the last section. There's a lot of our friends that, because we started doing this pod, are now more into the Premier League, and they're constantly saying, like, who should I support? I've always pushed people towards Crystal Palace, but I would love to get, like I said, at the end, maybe a little pitch from you to say, like, hey,
this is what we got to offer.
Exactly. So, Jack, I want to be able to start with how you became a Palace fan, but I think when you decide to create content around one team, you can kind of elevate yourself in just regular fandom to probably being somewhere obsessed, somewhere a little bit more into it than most people. I know that here in America, we don't have the luxury all the time of being born into fandom. I know that's technically usually how it happens in England. But give us the background on you becoming a Crystal Palace fan and working with FYP and how it's grown.
Yeah, so I actually wasn't born into fandom. I was actually born into Evertonian fandom, which is, before we started recording, I said that I would have words with your brother, who's of the red persuasion on Merseyside. Yeah. But my dad and my grandfather are true Evertonians. My grandfather was born on Penny Lane, and massive Evertonians. My dad followed him. And then my family eventually moved down south and settled in South London. And when I was growing up, there were two massive influences in my life football-wise. One was Palace because of the locality. I was born and raised in SC25, and Everton because my dad was Everton crazy. And basically, my football fandom kind of occurred on one day in 1994 when Palace played Everton. And I think that probably had the biggest outcome in terms of who I support and who I follow today. And Palace won 1-0. A guy called Andy Priest, who didn't do much in a Palace shirt, but he scored the winner that day. And my dad, who I must say, my dad has a very big soft spot for Palace as well. Having, grown up in Croydon himself meant that he saw a lot of Palace with his friends in his youth. And me supporting Palace was a lot of a cheaper option for him than if I'd supported Everton and we were up at Merseyside every other week. So, he let me follow Palace, and it's been Palace ever since. And my cousins and my friends support Palace, so the football's great, but it's the kind of, friend element as well that is so strong for going to Palace. And then in terms of FYP, I've been friends with the guys probably for like 10 years or so. And then during lockdown, they invited me on an episode of the podcast, and I haven't really left since. So,
Just so you're, like I explained to you, you're like a couple other members on this podcast that...
absolutely.
I think he's going to get tired of me bringing this up every podcast, but we like to joke with him that he filled in and just never left. I think the thing for me, again, mentioning being like the second favorite team, and the funniest part is, as a City fan, Palace somewhat has been a bogey team for us here and there, and there's been incredible goals that they've, tied us or beat us with. And I think for me, I got to watch a Men in Blazers, which is, again, an American podcast here. They went to Selhurst Park, and I compare Premier League football and European football to only one thing in the United States, and that's college football, like college American football, right? I thought that the fandom at Selhurst Park was the most incredible thing I've seen. I thought that there was just passionate people, all ages going to the stadium, cheering the entire time. And being from Ohio, and I live in New York now, but being from Ohio as an Ohio State Buckeyes mm-hmm. football fan. I was like, I know what this is. I've seen this. This is similar to how I grew up. What is it like at Selhurst on not even an important game, but just in general? Like, how does that energy get translated to the fans and then hopefully to the players? What is it like going to a game? Because we've never gone here.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I mean, for me, there are a few better places on earth, really, than being in the Homesdale Lower while Palace are either chasing an equaliser or chasing a winner in the last 20 minutes of a game. Mm-hmm. Particularly in the depths of winter, there's just something about it with everybody in their massive coats just willing the ball in. And you're right, the fan base is still quite native in the sense that it's very South London and proud, and the club mm-hmm. make a massive effort to kind of market that. I'm sure we'll touch on Wilfred Zaha a moment ago, but there's a guy who, you know, played such a pivotal role for the club over such a long time, and he grew up literally two roads away from the ground and famously told stories of not knowing what the big light in the sky was, you know, as he looked out his bedroom window and there's Selhurst Park. So, you know, the local community's of vital importance to the club. It provides the vibrancy that you guys see on television from across the Atlantic, and it's a great club to be part of. I feel privileged to be a Palace fan, to be honest. I talk to my friends who live over here who have connections with United or Liverpool or Arsenal, and it's not the same. I don't think they have the same connection. It's probably very arrogant of me to think like that, but you do. When it's so close to you, you feel it's part of you. And, you know, the friendship groups that I've made up, you know, with friends and family, and then since being on the podcast, it's been a joy, to be honest. And I love going to watch Palace, home or away. I'm lucky enough to be in a position where I can go and watch Palace away from home as well. And away ends are, you know, a fascinating concept to most Americans and most overseas fans as well. I went and watched a game in Italy at the start of this year, and I think there were about 40 away fans at the top of one of the stands in the San Siro, whereas Palace would take 3,000 people away every other weekend to watch them. You know, whatever the form on the pitch, typically we sell out our away end because there is that fanatic element that we just love watching Palace and being with our friends and family. So yeah, it's a joy. Yeah, I love going to games. I love going to any game, to be honest. I've seen games in most countries that I've been. I love to watch football in different, a bit, just a football nut. But in terms of Palace, yeah, it's just something very close to my heart. And I think if you do ever get to a game at Palace, you'll remember it because that kind of atmosphere. And the ground is so different to so many other grounds in the Premier League now. You know, the ground is rumoured to be being redeveloped in the near future. John Textor is involved. I'm sure, you know, your listeners will be aware of that American investor with two other Americans who are involved in investments. But there's a massive plan to redevelop parts, and it'll be the biggest redevelopment of the ground for at least 30 years. But in terms of, you know, outlook, it'll be the biggest and most fundamental change of the ground for probably 50 or 60 years at least. So there's something very old school about the ground, and away fans hate coming to the ground. They always say it's difficult to get to. So there's just a charm about it being our home, to be honest, and I love it.
It's so interesting as an American, and I've been to England once. I got to tour both Anfield and the Etihad, but while I was in London, I don't know if my mom knew what she was getting into, but we stayed in Chelsea, and I walked from Chelsea all the way to Fulham and back, and I think halfway there, she was like, what are we doing? Like, what kind of trip is this? But I try to tell a lot of my friends who have never seen a old school like football stadium in England that, let me show you a picture of Fulham. Let me show you what's around Fulham, because we're so used to the out in the suburbs, humongous parking lot, big, you know, stadium with all the jumbotrons and whatnot. And I think that the next time I'm in London, I have it earmarked to try to go to Selhurst Park to be able to see it as well. But being able to be in a neighborhood setting, it honestly had an imagination to myself to be like, I don't know what this is like. There's nothing like this. It's like high school. Like sports, to be able to walk through a neighborhood to get to a stadium and whatnot. I wanted to ask, and I mentioned beforehand that how we do our podcast and look at things is try to put a bit of an American lens on it so that if someone doesn't know anything about soccer, anything about football, they can listen and be like, all right, like I kind of understand this. We always struggle with Palace. I think it might be that there is so much polarization in the United States in general. We don't have to go into all of that, but like in sports especially, you're either ready to compete for a title or you are rebuilding and you are somewhere in the bottom and you're hoping, obviously we have the draft for all of our sports, a draft pick
absolutely.
There. And when I explain Palace to people, I go, hey, the last 5 years, 11th, 12th, 14th, 14th, 12th. And I think for us on the pod, we always struggle with, if you're a Palace fan, what do you think about before the season starts? What are you like excited about? What are you hoping for? How do you explain that to us, if you even can, of like, what's the mindset of a Palace fan before every season?
I mean, right back at you in the sense of the differences in our sports. I mean, I am a 49ers fan because my dad lived in San Francisco and he bought that bat. And I remember a few years ago, it had an absolute stinker of a season. And then they got Nick Bosa second in the draft and it transformed everything. And like one, literally one draft pick. Okay, they got Debo Samuel and, you know, in the second round. But in terms of one draft pick, being that high in the draft meant they got, you know, a player of a generational talent like Bosa. And he completely changed the dynamic of the club. Obviously, English sport isn't the same. We don't have the draft system. And it is, you know, very different in that sense. But for Palace, I guess for someone that doesn't know much about Palace, is Palace are currently in their longest spell of top flight football in the history. So this is our 11th season of top flight football. So Premier League, but before that, Division One. And Palace's longest spell before this spell was 4 years in a row in the top division. So we are exceeding historic precedent in that sense. So relatively speaking, we're in a period of great success for the club. But fans are not especially satisfied by just accepting the status quo and want us to push on. And understandably, you pay your money, you have as much love and adoration for a club, you want them to push on and develop a bit more. So there's that balance between fans of, wow, we're riding the good times, we know this isn't going to last forever, but could it be a bit more exciting? Could it be a bit better? Could we have a bit more investment in the playing staff? Could the facilities be a little bit better? But the club have kind of gone through the infrastructure route where they've completely regenerated the training ground and completely redeveloped the approach to youth development. And I think that's the way the club are looking to sustain itself. But on the pitch, which is what overseas fans, like, you know, listeners to your podcast are probably looking at, that does mean that we look a little bit static in our league position. And in 10 years of Premier League football up to this point, we've only finished in the top half once. So, you know, we are treading the line, that zip wire, in the sense of, if you hang around in that part of the table for too long, you're probably going to flirt with relegation. But truth be told, there hasn't really been an April or a March, a March, April, May that we've gone into and thought, wow, we're really in trouble here. Last season was maybe getting to that point, but then the decision was made to sack Patrick Vieira and Roy Hodgson returned and did what Roy did with 10 games to go. And he's now been rewarded with another year, which I still don't know how I feel about that. We may come on to that in a moment. You know, it's... It's an interesting place to be. And unfortunately, the owners who have done so much for the club in terms of getting us to where we are, then start to receive the negative kind of fan feedback that, you know, borders on ridiculous. But it's fair comment in the sense of, could it, you know, it's good times, but could it be even better? But it's a difficult sell for Palace. But that's why the kind of South London and proud, the kind of fanatic element, that is what the attraction to overseas fans is and why people note us, because typically speaking, it's not our form on the pitch that gets people talking about us.
Well, you mentioned someone that I do want to bring up, because I think along with the atmosphere of Selhurst Park, like I said, that I got to watch on a television, but I could feel it through there. I really loved watching Wilfred Zaha. I loved watching him play. I loved the tenacity. Again,
you and me both. You and me both, John. You and me both.
Getting in my own like Man City players' faces at times, and I could sit there and be like, I want that. I want that in my team. I want that in my club. One, I guess a two-part question, and then we can kind of go into what this next year is going to bring and start with the transfers there. But you talked about the club being able to push on. Were there a majority of the fans that thought, while he was here and having such a talent here, you would have touched European football, you would have touched top, you know, eight, whatever you want to, you know, put your marker of success as. And now that he is gone, what is going to be that feeling at the park, and what is going to be that feeling of his time there? And I don't know if you can say it's a failure, because again, it's so important to be able to stay in that top flight. And I listened to the Rebecca Lowe podcast, and one of the clips you said where she's like, I left and didn't think I'd, you know, ever watch us in the top flight anyway. We just got up there. I didn't think I was missing anything. And now, lo and behold, she's missed the whole thing. But, you know, did you think that it was going to happen with him? And now that he's gone, what is that time going to kind of look like in retrospect?
I guess the sadness is that we didn't reach or, yeah, we didn't reach European football, or we never saw Will lift, you know, an FA Cup or a League Cup in a Palace shirt. We came close. 2016, we lost to Manchester United in the extra time of the FA Cup final, which I still can't watch back. Jesse Lingard scores the winner, and I literally can't watch anything with that guy's face on it. But you kind of answered the question for me in that what Wilf did was sustain the club as a Premier League force, and he's leaving the club in a far stronger position. I know some fans would say, well, you know, we're only 11th or still mid-table, but the idea that Palace would have 10 years in the Premier League football, to, as Rebecca Lowe said when we interviewed her at Christmas time, the idea that Palace would be in the Premier League for, or going into an 11th season, I can promise you, not one Crystal Palace fan that was at Wembley the day we beat Watford to come up would have believed that we'd have 10 years. I think the vast majority of fans are like, let's have a good time. We're here for a good time, not a long time. And here we are with, you know, far better infrastructure, some incredible players still on. You know, some Palace fans would tell you that, you know, we've got a terrible team and we've got no depth. We've got some unbelievable players still at the football club, and maybe we'll talk about them in a moment. But I'm sad that Wilf didn't have that crowning moment in a Palace shirt, but he had so many moments in a Palace shirt that, for me, he goes down as the greatest player that's ever worn the shirt. You know, a lot of Palace fans, maybe of a slightly older than me, would reference Ian Wright, who played for Palace in the 80s before he went to Arsenal. But Wilfred Zaha is a god in my mind. And you mentioned kind of the residential area, the kind of urban setting of English football grounds. Just before the end of last season, the club commissioned on the side of the house that is opposite the Holmesdale end. They arranged for a full side of house mural dedicated to Wilfred Zaha. You may well have seen some of the social stuff. It looks incredible.
Yeah.
And I think some fans hope that was going to be the nudge towards the announcement of an extension to his contract or something like that. It didn't come. He had an injury towards the end of last season. So his last game, the last game of the season, he kind of walked on at the end of the pitch and waved to the fans. But we didn't know whether we were saying goodbye or whether he'd be back in August. So Wilf leaving does still strike me as feeling quite underwhelming. It's quite sad that he's left without the moment to have that massive goodbye that he fully justifies. And it's 2 weeks now since it was announced that he's leaving, and I've kind of made my peace with it. I was a bit moody, to be honest, when it got announced. So I don't care, you know, whatever, it doesn't matter. But I hope he has a great time and a new challenge for him. And he's given Palace the best year of his career. There's no denying that. We've had Wilfred Zaha from 21 to 31. And that's an incredible, you know, period to have of a player's career. And we've had, don't get me wrong, he's been rewarded financially, and but we've had the best of Wilfred Zaha. I think it would take a lot for him to exceed what he achieved at Palace in Turkey at Galatasaray. He may well win trophies, but that's probably more to do with Galatasaray standing in the Turkish Super League rather than anything else. I wish him all the best. I think we've still got talents that mean that we can still do what we need to next season. And there are a lot of Palace fans, myself maybe included in this, of offering him the contract that we did, 4 years, £200,000 a week. It's a massive offer. But for a player who had 3 muscle injuries in the last 4 months of the season, maybe it was heart overall in the head, and possibly the club will be better for Wilf not signing that extension. But still very sad to see him go, and it's peculiar seeing him wearing a different shirt. I'm just grateful that he's not in the Premier League playing for another Premier League club, because that was my fear of him coming back to Selhurst and making us all regret not seeing him in a Palace shirt any longer.
Yeah, I think that you brought up a good point with the muscle injuries. He may very well be doing you all one last favor by not signing it, to be honest with you.
He's just cementing his greatest of all time.
Yeah, exactly.
By looking after the club's finances.
He does it. I've seen a few pictures of him in a gala like shirt, and I'm just like, this doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
Yeah.
You had mentioned having some talents in the club. I do want to talk about, you know, what you think is going to come this year. Who do you think is going to shine? But we mentioned transfers. Wilf's out. I put Jack Butland in here just because I have like a weird FIFA love affair with him, but it's fine.
We've all got those players who mean something to us on a save computer game. he was an interesting one because technically he left this summer, but in essence, he left last January when he went to United.
Yep.
But he's got to move north of the board. He's going to be Rangers number one, which is it's a two-club league, but it's a massive league, and he'll play in some big games up there, so all the best to him. And in terms of incomings, you know, throw some names at me that you've got there. I mean, there's only one, I think, and there's two announced
Two. Yeah. So those, but they're two big ones because one, I'm sure that you know more about Matheus Franca, and I hope I'm saying that right, from Flamengo than I do. I know that the Brazilian league obviously is great for producing talent, and it's a signing that, again, only being Palace adjacent, I don't ever really remember them diving into South America to bring a young talent in. But then, in all honesty, in our own group chat, we talked about this. We think Jefferson Lerma is a very good signing for Palace to help out in the middle and the spine of the team. So would love to get your thoughts on both of them.
Yeah, two South American players joining. One who is very experienced in English football, mm-hmm. Jefferson Lerma. Matheus Franca, I believe is how it's pronounced. Okay, but perfect. I may have butchered his name there. We'll probably have to lean on Brazilian football experts to say it, but I think Franca is sure. How you say. I do know his name transfers to Matthew France in English, so slightly less exotic. I think we'll go with Franca. But he is our first kind of delving into that South American mm-hmm. pool of talents. Chelsea are doing it almost every day at the moment, signing the next Brazilian or Argentine wonder kid. But Franca's name has been linked with Palace for a long time now. So it's very pleasing to see paper talk and rumours actually come into fruition and see him wear the shirt and be unveiled. I think there's a lot of excitement about him, but I think at the same time, a lot of Palace fans are wary of putting too much expectation on his shoulders so soon. I mean, the guy's 19. I think he's played 20 first-team games for Flamengo. Excited fans when he's played, but typically he's had cameos of 15, 20 minutes and played in cup competitions for Flamengo. But the expectation is that it's a worthwhile investment, and in time we will see a real player. I suspect we'll see glimpses of that this season. I'd be surprised if he flourishes that much this season because of just, you know, the change in kind of circumstance and situation for him. But very exciting signing, and it's the type of signing that Palace are starting to make. We've seen it with Eberechi Eze, Michael Olise, Mark Gaye, in terms of buying young relatively cheaply in the hope that you will then sell for a significant profit moving on. So that's very exciting. And I think the Jefferson Lerma signing is one more based for the now. And he comes into the midfield pretty much as a starter. And he'll start alongside Cheick Doucouré and Eberechi Eze in a midfield three. He was Bournemouth's player of the season last year. And yeah. Bournemouth comfortably saw off relegation. So I think 5 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, he cost Bournemouth £30 million. So in terms of transfer market value, he's probably still hovering between that £25 and £30 million. Mm-hmm. So if we paid that for him, I think there'd probably be more excitement of what a great signing. But because he's kind of come under the radar, I think Palace fans appreciate what a good signing he's going to prove to be. But maybe outside the club might take a bit of time for people to realise, oh, he plays for Palace now and that type of thing. But I'm excited. I think he improves us straight away and he won't take time to adapt because he was playing in the league last season. So, good signing. The type of signing that while you make exciting signings of youngsters, you need to kind of add at the same time to improve you for the here and now rather than looking 2 or 3 years ahead.
Yeah, I think, again, I'm now naming the third thing that attracted me to Palace, but, you know, I mentioned living in New York. I grew up in Ohio. I'm a Cleveland fan. So you even knowing the 49ers a little bit, you can understand that there's a lot of pain in my heart and in my soul fandom-wise there. And I looked at the Jefferson Lerma signing as the type of signing where you're not rolling him out in front of all the cameras, you're not doing all of this like parade to have him in and whatnot, but because he has the pedigree and because he has that experience, if it works out, he's actually going to have the biggest impact. Because baseball, basketball, football wise here in Cleveland, it's those signings where it's like, hey, we got a veteran to come in to talk to some of the younger guys, teach them about playing in the Premier League week in and week out, and to make an impact right away on the field. It moves you, and in this case, it could move you from maybe 12th to 9th or 12th to 8th, hopefully, fingers crossed for you all. But I looked at it, and I was like, this is smart. This is a smart signing. This is, and for a free, is kind of incredible that I don't really know what Bournemouth was doing. But
yeah, I listened to a Bournemouth podcast shortly after. Well, we got rumoured with him, and through the podcast, we started to hear things maybe towards the end of last season, and I listened to a Bournemouth podcast, and I think they announced that he was leaving the club before the end of last season so he could get the fanfare. And basically the club gambled at the start of last season of, if we keep him and he keeps us up, he's worth the £15 million that we might get for a transfer. And he proved it. He played 33 or 34 games for them. He scored 6 or 7 goals. His contribution in staying at Bournemouth was probably worth it. So for them, it was worth a gamble. But then they had the bittersweet pill of losing somebody who they voted themselves their best player of the season. Yeah. So I think you're right. I think he improves us now. And I think he'll start on Saturday away at Sheffield United. And I think if you are making summer transfers, if you can get any of them to improve your team in the here and now, I think that's the absolute A grade. Don't listen to the podcast in 3 months' time if I'm bad-mouthing him and saying what a terrible signing he was. But, you know, a guy who's got as much English football experience, age 28, on a free transfer, not for astronomical wages, I think is a very shrewd piece of business for Palace.
Yeah, for sure. So you mentioned the roster. I know for a fact that there are some really impressive talents on the team. I may be sitting here, and you may be mad about this, but kind of hoping that Elise finds himself in Manchester in a few weeks, honestly. I really like his game. But if you're looking at this roster, what are you excited about? What players are you saying, hey, if you're going to tune into Palace, these are the guys that are going to get us that late equalizer or get us the winner? And then on the other hand, where is there maybe a weakness? And I want to also separate that. I want to have a whole different Hodgson conversation afterwards, because I love the man, but I want to hear about that too.
So we'll leave the Roy chat afterwards. So I think the ghost of Wilf leaves, you know, Palace fans worrying for next season, but I think Palace fans can only be encouraged by the form of Eberechi Eze towards the end of last season. You know, he ended last season with 10 league goals. His form at the end of the season warranted an England call-up. He had his first England appearance in June, and that was fully justified. His form towards the end of last season was incredible. And the turnaround in his form was equally as incredible, because the game before Patrick Vieira got sacked was Brighton away, which is quite a meaningful fixture for Palace fans. And Eze came on for 45 minutes and stunk the place out. He was terrible. And I was really starting to wonder what his role in the squad was going to be. I was thinking, if this form carries on, I could see him being sold relatively soon. Then Roy came back in and basically just caressed the ego and told him that he's as great as he can be. And, you know, he won games by himself. His form transformed, just unbelievably. It was just an incredible transformation. And in pre-season, he's shown some lovely touches. We played Sevilla in Detroit as part of our pre-season. And if fans haven't seen the goal that he scores in that game, have a look for it. It's just lovely football. He picks up the ball 45 yards out, beats 4 or 5 players and slots it between the keeper's legs. And that's how we all dream of playing football when we play at the park. And that's how he plays. He's just such an instinctive, gifted footballer. It's a joy to watch him. I suspect we will only have him for one more year. He has 2 years left in his contract. And I suspect he's probably thinking, by the time next summer comes around, he'll be 25, nearly 26. And it might be time for a move for a club playing Champions League football. He's genuinely that good. So he's someone to watch while in a Palace shirt. And then the other one you mentioned, Michael Olise, who's just, again, a purely instinctive footballer. He absolutely loves the ball. The ball loves him. The worry is that he doesn't start next season with Palace at the moment. There are some rumours related to a clause in his contract, and both Chelsea and Manchester City are known to be interested in that. If that fee is the £35 million that is quoted, I can't believe the queue of clubs isn't out the door, because £35 million for a player who I think is going to be worth at least double that. I actually think he's probably worth double that now, given how prodigious his talent is and the fact he's only 22. I think he's absolutely outstanding. But he has a clause in his contract. We benefited from him having a clause in his contract when we signed him from Reading 2 summers ago. So we have to play the game that he wants to play. And for him to play for Palace, he had to have a clause in his contract. So it's a shame if he does go, but he's going to miss the start of the season regardless. He picked up quite a bad injury playing for France in the under-21 Euros in the summer. So he's a wonderful talent. So when he's fit and hopefully still wearing the red and blue of Palace, him and Eze, there's a lot of hopes on him. But there are other players. Cech Doucouré, a midfielder we signed last year from France. At times, he was a one-man midfield for us last year and ended up winning our Player of the Season award. Voted for by fans, and just kind of summed up what an impressive first season he had. And then defensively, Mark Gay, another England international who we signed from Chelsea 2 years ago, and Joachim Andersen, a Danish international who previously had played for Fulham on loan. The two of them, there's a kind of English phrase regarding centre-halves, and the two of them are what we would call Rolls-Royce defenders, that they just make it look so easy.
Yep.
They do just make everything look so easy. And there's a sense that they are a partnership because they signed in the same summer and they play so well together that the notion, again, of one of those two leaving kind of breaks my heart because they are a duo. But again, particularly Mark Gay was signed with that notion of buy young, relatively cheap and look to sell for a significant profit. The only thing that's a mystery with him is why on earth Chelsea sold him, because that guy is absolutely superb. And they sold him to us for around £18 million and then spent £80 million on Wesley Fofana from Leicester. It's that type of transfer dealing that just makes me question who's signing these players for the money they're signing them on.
There's no love lost on this podcast with Chelsea fans, actually. That's our one rivalry across the board. I think American Chelsea fans especially are some of the more annoying people you can... I don't want to speak that way, but no, I totally agree. And I think for
They've
us...
They've learned their lesson. They have learned their lesson this year with Levi Colwill.
Yes, absolutely. So that actually is a great point. Like I mentioned you before, we did a series last summer where we previewed each team. And as Americans, we do like to raise our hand when we think we got something right. And my brother and I, when we did the Palace one, we mentioned Decore making a huge impact. We were like, this is going to be a good player. We said that he's going to be the best signing for you guys. We said that he's going to, you know, start right away. And you just mentioned Levi Colwill. I can't tell you the number of times on any one number team that we did last summer where we're like, hey, who should they sign? Who would help them out? I think I mentioned him four times just because Chelsea was clearly not bringing him back. And I was like, hey, get him. Somebody get him, please. And I think that he's going to develop very, very well there for sure.
Well, I think he had such a good season at Brighton last year that it would have been ridiculous for them to have sold him regardless of what had happened previously with Mark Gaye. But the dealing with Gaye just looks such a bad deal on Chelsea's part now that even if they didn't have plans for Colwill this season, I don't think they'd be seen to sell another talent who is clearly so capable. But good call on him because he'd only played championship football before last season. And don't like to praise Brighton too much being a Palace fan, but he was genuinely so impressive last year. And my tip for this year is that Levi Colwill will go to the Euros next year for England at Euro 2024. I think he'll be a Chelsea starter this year and I think he'll be starting for England at the next Euros.
Yeah, I would not put money against that, put it that way.
He's very good, yeah.
So we have a few running jokes about Roy Hodgson on this pod, and just, you know, scanning your Instagram, the FYP Instagram, it sounds like you're having a little bit of fun of the entire scenario too. I don't know if it's AI or you guys have the best, you know, Photoshop person in the world, but the pictures of him in a Grand Theft Auto getup or the pictures of him in a... I think it's the Back to the Future 1-2 are hilarious. Yeah.
I think they might have been AI. I think we have to give credit to AR rather than any individual right. associated with FYP.
You should own it and just say, yeah, no, our editing team's amazing. The joke that we play here is when he got called back, we like to envision him in a nice cottage in the English countryside, answering a rotary phone and just saying to his wife, like, hey, I got to go back to work. Like, I don't want to. But they need me and whatnot. So with that said, what are the feelings? I'm sure that there is a lot of sympathy and love for someone who, again, saw you stay in the Premier League a few seasons in a row and come back and right the ship on a team that, if I'm being totally honest, we had really high hopes for Palace last year, especially after the first game against Arsenal. We watched it and we were like, they look good. And I think Vieira has it figured out.
Despite the 2-0 defeat, we still gave them quite a game.
It's the funniest thing. Like, if you watch sports and you play sports, you know that statement's real. I think if someone's new to it, they're just like, they got beat 2-0. He's like, no, but it's the game itself. They look so good.
Yeah.
But what are the feelings about Hodgson? What can you tell us that fans over there feel about bringing him back and having him stay?
So there's a lot of things about Roy that maybe people not as close to the club may not appreciate. So Roy is from Croydon. Roy went to the same school as my dad, which was, you know, 2 miles up the road from the ground. So Croydon's in his blood. He then went on to have this incredible international career, both at club and international level. So the man has achieved a hell of a lot But what comes with older age is this kind of comic narrative that comes with a football manager. But the guy is beyond qualified to be managing a Premier League club. The only thing is, he's now 76, and you know there is a challenge in a 76-year-old managing any Premier League club. And he'd had a spell at Watford the year before. I'm sure you would have noted this, but he had a spell at Watford, having left Palace in 2021, and his spell at Watford was very, very ineffective. And I think that probably said more about Watford than it did about Roy. But nonetheless, he was associated with a very bad team. But when Patrick Vieira got sacked, it was a very difficult decision because Vieira had had such an impactful 18 months as Palace manager, you know, that we'd had a very good season. The year before, he'd embedded a lot of new signings into the team. We got to the FA Cup semi-final. But the league form was a worry. And fundamentally, we have to remain a Premier League club. So the club made the call they did. And it became apparent very, very quickly. I think I did some press the day of the sacking, but within about 24 hours, it was quite clear that Palace had spoken to Roy Hodgson and Roy had indicated he would be willing to come back and do the job. Now, he did an incredible job. 10 games, I think 18 points from 10 games, 1.8 points a game, I think is Europa League form. You know, if that was over 38 games, we'd be, finishing sixth or seventh in the league, which would be amazing. But I don't think any Palace fan believes that Roy can truly see that through, given the limitations of our squad and his tactical defensiveness sometimes. He is notoriously defensive and was in his last 2 years at Palace, in his first spell. But perhaps that was more to do with the type of player that he had at his disposal. When he's given technical, more attacking players, he lets us play. He lets us cook, I think, is what the young kids call it. And he does. And he's, you know, there are moments where he let... I mean, I mentioned the Eze free role that he gave him last year and he saw the impact of that. So the thing with Roy last year is I felt it was just a beautiful moment for him to come back because his previous goodbye had been during lockdown. I think there were 5,000 fans at Selhurst when he got to have his last goodbye. Whereas this year he would have had a full Selhurst rocking to say goodbye. And there was a bit of a delay in us announcing him, but I think it was pretty much a done deal, to be honest. And he's here for another year. I don't know the logic. I presume that they considered other candidates who are either attached to other clubs who aren't currently available, or maybe the type of candidate they want just wasn't available, and therefore Roy is a relatively safe pair of hands. And if anyone's listening that listens to the FYP, one of my fellow panellists, Joe Walker, said or compared Roy to a comfortable pair of shoes. And Roy was then, he had that quoted to him in an interview after that first game, which was against Leicester. And he wasn't best pleased at being compared to an old pair of shoes. But Joe meant it from a purely loving perspective, that it was like the comfortable place of Roy knows the place, we know Roy. But he was a little bit offended. And I think Roy probably still considers himself a bit of a firebrand. I think he still thinks he can innovate and do new things. And he may well be able to. And I have a lot of trust in Roy Hodgson. I think that's what a lot of Palace fans would probably tell you, that he's a known entity. He knows inside football. Next to him, he's got an assistant coach called Ray Lewington, who during lockdown, any listeners that were listening to Palace on television, the man you heard shouting on the touchline was Ray Lewington. He was the only noise you could hear during lockdown. So the Palace have made that decision. Steve Parrish, Palace chairman, very close with Roy Hodgson. It makes a lot of sense, but again, it's a bit of an underwhelming appointment in that it's not that star name that maybe some fans wanted.
I think that I want to ask a quick question. The thing that struck me is you mentioned 78 again. Here in the United States, 78 is young enough to still be president, which is totally fine.
76. He's a whippersnapper.
Absolutely. I think when we've always thought about it too, because we, on the face of it, didn't think he'd be back for another year. We were like, hey, he's doing such a service to keep them up, right the ship, get him going. When we were posed with, who do you get? I think that the options are just so small right now. And again, you are going to have more insight than I would about this, but I couldn't off the top of my head be like, this person makes a ton of sense, or that person makes a ton of sense.
Yeah, there were no obvious candidates, and there were rumours of some names from the continent. Adi Hütter, who I think had previously managed Eintracht Frankfurt relatively successfully, he was linked. Steve Cooper, current Nottingham Forest manager, was linked. Some other names from the championships are Michael Carrick, ex-Manchester United midfielder. He's now managing Middlesbrough. He was linked. Kieran McKenna from Ipswich, previous Manchester United coach, was linked. But I think Parrish, the chairman, probably just looked at those younger names and went, I can't guarantee they're going to be any good. I can't. Yeah. They've not managed in the Premier League, whereas you can't lay that accusation at Roy Hodgson. He's done everything. He's seen it all. There are very few instances that could occur that Roy would look at everyone and be like, I don't know what to do. I don't know where to steer the ship. And you described him as steering the ship, and that's how Steve Parrish sees the football club. Steer it out the way from harm and keep it safe and keep us heading in the right direction. That's ultimately what the football club needs to be, safe.
In a thought to losing someone like Zaha and then maybe compounding that with losing the same type of presence of Hodgson in Steve Parrish's mind may have just been too much of like, hey, I know it's only two people, but that's a huge transition for this team.
And he was very close with Wilf. Steve Parrish. I mean, I don't know. I Steve Parrish was a very successful businessman before he took over chairmanship of Palace. But I dare say that probably played some part of his thinking of, you know, it's a known quantity. Wilf going, some other changes around the club. You know, Roy is a safe pair of hands in that sense. Yeah. So, and respected by Palace fans. There's no accusation. And if there were any doubts about what he could do, the fact he didn't just see Palace over the line last year. Like, we were safe within three games of Roy coming back. The first three games, he won, and we were practically safe. We effectively relegated Southampton by winning 2-0 at their place. We thrashed Leeds 5-1 in his second game. I mean, that's the thing. I think Roy surprised people so much that actually the balloon of optimism that around Roy probably softened some fans' concern that it's not the right appointment. But I think at least another season in Roy we trust is probably what we need to say.
We did a pod after the third game. I remember now that we were like, how did they let this guy go? Like, you know, exactly. All right, I'm going to ask the tough question. Like I mentioned, last five seasons, 14th to 11th is where you all have been. We went through a lot of the bright spots, maybe some of the areas that we need to improve. You think the team may need to improve. What is the actual prediction that you have for this team? And you can just do the Premier League, or if you want to be bold enough to say, hey, we're going to have a cup run in the FA Cup or the Carabao Cup, go right ahead.
Well, if there's anything that I would agree in terms of criticising Roy, it's that he's not particularly good in cup competitions. He in his four seasons that he had with Palace in the first place, he effectively threw us out of cup competitions with, you know, player selection. And it just never seemed, sorry, throwing us out seems, that's an accusation that I probably have to defend myself against, but it didn't seem a priority, and the Premier League was very much his focus. So I don't harbour much hope for a cup run this season under Roy. In terms of league, though, I mean, the guy knows how to, you know, get us through a league campaign. I think we will still be in that 11th to 15th spot. I think to advance into the top eight would be challenging. But I actually think some of the clubs that had better seasons last year will drop this year. I think naturally, I don't want to just say Brighton for the sake of it. I actually think they've made some very good transfer signings this summer. So I think they'll still be around. But you look at someone like Brentford, I think without Ivan Toney for the first half of the season, could really puncture them as a team. So I'd expect them to maybe fall a little bit. West Ham, you know, didn't have they're a bit of an unknown quantity in that Rice has gone, so they could, you know, maybe drop a little bit further and therefore push everyone else up a bit. I don't know. But I think between 11th and 15th is probably fair for us again. If you had to, you know, ask me for one prediction, I'd probably say 12th, just to pick a number out of the sky.
That's the number we associate with Palace the most.
That's us, number 12, lucky number 12.
We're in the same boat. We're with you and Brentford and West Ham. We have a lot of question marks around Fulham, especially.
Well, they're the other one in terms of those teams that finished above us. And, you know, Mitch, like I just mentioned, in terms of Ivan Toney, I don't know what the situation is with Alexander Mitrovic as of right now. But again, and I think even Willian signed a new contract and may already be looking to move on. So there's a lot of unknowns about Fulham, and, you know, I'm sure you've gotten onto the phrase second season syndrome, but they could have that this year. And we'll see. But I'm interested to see what happens with the newly promoted clubs. I think, you know, for Luton and Sheffield United, if they were to finish outside of the bottom three, I think for either one of those, it would probably rank as one of the greatest achievements in Premier League history. They're coming from such a low expectation.
Yeah.
I mean, today, reports over here that Sheffield United are about to sell their best player, Sander Berger, to Burnley. And he's only their best player because their best player until the weekend was Ndiaye, who they've just sold to Marseille. So they've sold their two best players from a championship season where they finished second a week before they've... I don't know what the inner politics of that club are at the moment. Luton are a fascinating story. You're going to hear a lot in international media about Kenilworth Road and what a peculiar ground it is and such a small club. As somebody who's been to that ground, I can tell you the novelty of fans going through somebody's garage to get into the away end is going to end very, very quickly. But it's a nice story. And what I do like is it's a different club coming up. You know, there have been a lot of the same clubs coming up. Your Norwich, your Watford. They come up, they go down, they come up, they go down. Whereas Luton haven't been in the top flight since before I was born. So that's a novelty. But for those two, it's going to be such a massive effort to get their head above 18th that I think a lot of clubs, Palace included, may be looking at trying to avoid one relegation spot this season. I think people would expect Burnley to have quite a good season, but I think a lot of that has to do with the kind of charm offensive that Vincent Kompany's done in the last year with the media. A bit of a media darling over here. So we'll see how they go, but their transfer dealings have looked fairly impressive. I've just mentioned their signing Sheffield United's best player. So you know they're doing things that every club should be doing. But there are a few clubs, and Palace always have to... The first aim has to be to stay up, and that will be the same this season as it's been for the last 10.
Yeah. All right. I mentioned this earlier. Like I said, I have a lot of friends that are now like getting into the Premier League, and I do my best. And I think, again, it's the Ohio in me. It is the Cleveland sports fan, and I don't mean that with any disrespect to Palace. You mentioned this before. You have friends that are Liverpool fans, friends that are Chelsea fans, friends that might be Man United fans, and they don't love the club as much as you love Palace. And I think that pain helps with that. I think if you feel pain with the team, you're going to be more connected, and Cleveland is the same way with that. So, for some of my friends that are looking for the club to support, why does Palace make sense? Why would it be a no-brainer for you to don the red and white, or red and blue. Sorry about that.
The red and blue, there, you're going to start talking about your flag, I thought, for a moment there. I think you start with a great point. I think our kit is pretty good. I think the red and blue is a great look.
1,000%. The away kit's the best away kit this year. It's not even close.
And we've just launched our third kit today, which I think is the best of the lot. So I think the kind of the red and blue... duo is a great look. I think it kind of separates us from a lot. But so the kit is where I would, you know, I'd start there. But there's actually a link between Palace and the USA. Palace's first ever player to play at a World Cup was Greg Berhalter in 2002.
Oh, wow.
And I think he's currently still employed pending internal investigations. He's still national team manager.
Investigation's over. We pulled a Roy Hodgson and brought him back too. Not that Roy did any of that other stuff, but yes, we did bring him back.
So Greg Berhalter played for Palace, and he played for the US at 2002 and became Palace's first ever World Cup player. So there's a link there. Jovan Karovski, I think of a similar era. He played for Palace in the early 2000s. And currently we've got a current US national men's team player in our roster, as you would call it. So Chris Richards joined us last year. His first season in a Palace shirt was curtailed by injuries at different points of the season. But when he did play, he looked very, very good and very assured. And you could see why Bayern Munich picked this kid up from Dallas, and he's got something about him. So I would hope that if you started following Palace this season, you might see a fair bit of a US international playing. I just think one thing I love about Palace is we don't take ourselves that seriously. So if you're looking for a club that you just want to have a good time and maybe have a few drinks watching, if you've got any trips over to England and you want to get a ticket, you're probably more likely to get a ticket to watch Palace than you are any other club, particularly in London. So there are lots of reasons. Really good podcast, FYP, if you want to listen to that.
I was going to say, great transition. I'll let you keep going, but I was like, hey, at the end of this, I would love for you to replug, but no, keep going.
Well, no, I think, and you talk, if you listen to us or any of the other podcasts that have emerged over the last few years, you get that sense that we don't take ourselves too seriously. And I would hope that while I've been talking with you for the last half hour or so, it comes across that it's just a love of football, really. And whatever happens with Palace in the future, the majority of Palace fans will still keep going. You know, it's not about playing everyone exciting in the league. It's not about, oh, wow, when we're playing Man United. That novelty's kind of gone now, and we've now returned to we just go to Palace to watch Palace. And as my cousin always says, if we have a bad day, don't let the football ruin a good day out. And that's pretty much how we live our lives as a Palace fan.
Yeah. Very well said. Jack, again, thank you so much for joining me, jumping on, and entertaining an American perspective on football. Please let my listeners know how they can follow you and the podcast, how often you guys post, you know, give me the full rundown.
Yeah, FYP, 5-year plan, has been going for a long time. We're coming up this winter to our 500th episode, which is something we're looking to celebrate, and we're hopeful to have a few guests on between now and Christmas, just to kind of celebrate that. And we have a combination of kind of post-match interviews for patrons. We have a patron that if people want to access kind of live feedback from a game, we try and post a podcast within 24 hours of a game. And that's very well received. And then we have a midweek pod, which is kind of free for everybody to have a listen. That pod is one that I more frequently appear on, and that is maybe after the dust has settled a bit. So less emotive. I've done the post-match pod a few times, and I typically am still bouncing off the walls or have steam coming out my ears. Whereas a few days later, I've let myself kind of recalibrate and find the middle ground a bit more. And then we have interviews with special guests, ex-Palace players, or people that have got associated with Palace. You mentioned the Rebecca Lowe interview that we had. And there's another reason, you know, Rebecca Lowe, who is the face of the coverage on NBC, she's a Palace fan. She learned her love of football by watching Palace. So yeah. If it's good enough for Rebecca Lowe, it's good enough for most people. And we had her on last year, and that was great. And maybe if you could link back to that, John, if that's all right, for listeners who, I guess that would be a good starting point for somebody who's so familiar to viewers in the States. But yeah, we post as much as we can and talk Palace as much as we can. And some of it makes sense and some of it doesn't. But that's podcasts in general, I find.
Becky Lowe, the patron saint of Saturday and Sunday mornings now here in the United States, which we love. Jack, thank you again. I love that you're able to join us. I know it's really busy for you all. Please go give them a follow, FYP Fanzine on Instagram, FYP Podcast, and hope to talk to you again soon. This was amazing.
Anytime, John, and depending on how Palace go, either good or bad throughout the season, maybe I'll jump back on with you and have a chat about Palace.
Love it. Thank you.
NAFTA podcast.
Sometimes it may be good, sometimes it may be shit.